A reading from the letter of James. You must understand this, my beloved. Let everyone be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to anger, for your anger does not produce God's righteousness. Therefore, rid yourselves of all sordidness and rank growth of wickedness, and welcome with meekness the implanted word that has the power to save your souls. But be doers of the word, and not merely hearers, who deceive themselves. For if any are hearers of the word and not doers, they are like those who look at themselves in a mirror, for they look at themselves, and on going away, immediately forget what they were like. But those who look into the perfect law, the law of liberty, and persevere, being not hearers who forget, but doers who act, they will be blessed in their doing. If any think they are religious and do not bridle their tongues but deceive their hearts, their religion is worthless. Religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this: to care for orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself unstained by the world. What good is it, my brothers and sisters, if you say that you have faith but do not have works? Can faith save you? If a brother or sister is naked and lacks daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, keep warm, and eat your fill, and yet you do not supply their bodily needs, what is the good of that? So faith by itself, if it has no works, is dead. But someone will say, you have faith, and I have works. Show me your faith apart from your works, and I, by my works, will show you my faith. You believe that God is one, you do well. Even the demons believe and shudder. Do you want to be shown, you senseless person, that faith apart from works is barren? Was not our ancestor Abraham justified by works when he offered his son Isaac on the altar? You see that faith was active along with his works, and faith was brought to completion by the works. Thus, the scripture was fulfilled that says, Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness, and he was called the friend of God. You see that a person is justified by works and not by faith alone. Likewise, was not Rahab the prostitute also justified by works when she welcomed the messengers and sent them out by another road? For just as the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without works is also dead. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi, and on the way he asked his disciples, who do people say that I am? And they answered him, John the Baptist, and others, Elijah, and still others, one of the prophets. He asked them, but who do you say that I am? Peter answered him, you are the Messiah. And he sternly ordered them not to tell anyone about him. Then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He said all this quite openly, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and looking at his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." He called the crowd with his disciples and said to them, if any want to become one of my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? Indeed, what can they give in return for their life? Those who are ashamed of me and of my words, in this adulterous and sinful generation of them, the Son of Man will also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels.
When I attended Bible college back in the early 90s, one of the courses I took was a course called hermeneutics. Now, hermeneutics is a technical word that speaks to how it is that a person interprets the Bible. And when you think of it that way, we all do that, don't we? Anytime we read the Bible and think about what it means, we then are interpreting it. We are doing hermeneutics. Now, it turns out that there are a number of different kinds of hermeneutics out there, a number of different ways to interpret the Bible. And when I was in Bible college, going to a Pentecostal Bible college, I was learning how to interpret the Bible in a Pentecostal way. Baptist churches would do it differently in some areas, Anglican churches would do it differently, and so on. And the reason why there are these different approaches to how we interpret the Bible is because every person who comes to the text, who reads a passage of the Bible and thinks about it, brings two things to the text. They bring their presuppositions and their prejudices. Now, what do those words mean? Well, basically, we all bring some assumptions when we read the Bible, and some of those assumptions can be spoken of positively, a presupposition, and some of them can be spoken of or can be described in a negative way. That's what a prejudice would be. So when we come to read the Bible, every last one of us has some assumptions we're making when we read it, which will affect how we interpret it, which is how we end up with different interpretations. And now it may not surprise you that, of course, sometimes these different interpretations can cause some conflict, even some controversy. There can even be arguing over whether the Bible really says that or really says this. And the reason why that debate exists at all is because of hermeneutics, the different ways we interpret the Bible. We're working through the letter of James right now, and the letter of James is one of the books of the New Testament that actually had been treated with a certain amount of controversy. Perhaps most well-known, or at least most notable, let's say, was back in the time of the Reformation. In the 1500s, Martin Luther, that Catholic monk who nailed those 95 theses on the door of the Wittenberg Chapel to kind of kick off what became known as the Reformation, he didn't think the letter of James should be in the Bible. He didn't like it. He thought it was a mistake that was made, albeit 1,200 years earlier, but he thought that actually doesn't belong in the New Testament. And the reason why was because of his hermeneutic, his approach to the Bible. So his presupposition, his positive assumption that he was making was that anything the Apostle Paul wrote was more important than what others will have written, in particular James. So that was his positive thing. The Apostle Paul is the guy to pay attention to. Now, why would he think that? Well, Christian tradition had it down for that at that time that the Apostle Paul was responsible for writing 14 of the 27 books in the New Testament. So you can imagine that someone might conclude, well, you know, if Paul wrote half of the New Testament, it makes sense that if there's anything that comes up that tends to, you know, conflict with Paul, that we should give Paul the benefit of the doubt and go with him. And so Luther thought that James didn't agree with Paul. Now, where is that coming from? In the letter of Ephesians, which has been traditionally identified as something Paul wrote, we read these words in chapter 2, verses 8 and 9. It is by grace that you have been saved through faith. And this is not of yourselves, it's a gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast. That's what Paul said, according to Martin Luther. But what does James say? James says, what good is it, my brothers and sisters, if you have faith but do not have works? Can faith save you? Can that kind of faith save you? And then he goes on and says, faith without works is dead. So it sounds like we have a contradiction. Paul says it is only through faith that we are saved, not by works. James says, if you don't have any works with your faith, it can't save you. So what do we do? Well, first of all, we understand that's where Martin Luther was coming from. That's why he took that approach and didn't like the letter of James. Well, okay, acknowledging that, how could we view this now? One approach we could take is to say, as a presupposition, the Bible records the ways that people were thinking in the early days of the Christian faith, and what we have here simply is James having one approach to the faith in Jesus, and Paul having a different approach. And James's approach came first, and Paul's came later, so all we're seeing is two guys who are taking a look at the same thing a little bit differently. And maybe we should just let it sit there and just acknowledge that there's different approaches to this. There's certainly some merit to that, for sure. And let's not forget, James is writing because he's wanting to keep in touch with a congregation who's had to flee Jerusalem because of persecution. They've left fearing for their lives and their livelihoods, and James is wanting to stay in touch with them and say, here's how you have to live the Christian life, keep these things in mind. And of course, that persecution was coming to them because of a man named Saul, who only later becomes a Christian and becomes Paul, who then gets to write what we say he wrote in Ephesians. So James's idea comes before Paul's idea. So maybe James's perspective should take precedence over Paul's. That would be a hermeneutic. That would be an interpretive move to take. Well, over time, we've learned, by the way, that the Apostle Paul did not write 14 books of the New Testament. Some books we know absolutely he didn't write. It used to be that we thought Paul wrote Hebrews, but now it's been proven, no, he definitely did not. There are other books that we can't say one way or the other, like maybe it could have been Paul, but maybe not. We're just not really sure. Others, like Ephesians, it's quite certain Paul didn't write that one. Really, we're left with half a dozen books that we know that Paul wrote. I mean, even still, that's a significant percentage out of the 27 books in the New Testament. But is that a sufficient reason to say that Paul should supersede James? Perhaps not. Let's add another thing to the mix here. If, as many Christians do, a person feels that since the Bible is the Word of God, it must be perfect and infallible and inerrant. In other words, there can be no mistakes in the Bible whatsoever. If a person brings that presupposition to the text, then when they see this contradiction, it seems, between James and, let's just keep saying, Paul in Ephesians, well, this can't be a contradiction because the Bible's perfect. It's not wrong. So how are we going to deal with this? And on the basis of that, a person will look closely and say, okay, well, let's see. It is by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is a gift of God. So we got saved, and it was faith. And then James says, can faith without works actually save? But what's really going on here is James is already talking to people who are Christians, right? So what it is the Apostle Paul is talking about how one gets saved, and there's nothing you can do to earn that. You can't convince God to save you. You can't do enough good deeds to get saved. There's nothing you can do. It's a gift that God gives you. So it's just yours, and you receive it by faith. So yeah, I guess you got to believe in Jesus, which is actually doing something. But let's just put that aside. So the idea is that you get saved as a gift of God. And then what James is talking about is after you have been saved, it shows that you really are saved because you're doing these good works. So there is an interpretive solution if we want to keep the presupposition in place that the Bible can't have any contradictions in it. If, of course, we don't have that presupposition, we can just let these two versions be there and just live with the tension. Or we can also look more closely at what we're talking about. When I describe that thing, the before and after getting saved thing, when we think of what salvation means in that way, we basically think of it as being, this is our ticket to heaven, right? Getting saved means when you die, you know you're going to go to heaven. So whatever happens in life, good, bad, everything else, the point is, you're on your way to heaven when this life is over. That's what is part of that discussion I just gave. But there's a problem if we take that. On the one hand, if we get our ticket to heaven because God is giving us this wonderful gift, well, that's pretty cool. But then if the proof that we have our ticket to heaven is in the works we do, the things that we do, well, that can lead to a real quandary. Because now, if you don't have works, which means your faith is dead, that means you don't have the ticket to heaven. So how many works do you have to do to ensure you've got the ticket to heaven? What kinds of things have to be done? I mean, the last thing we want to do is find out that we don't have the ticket after all, right? And so if we take that view of what it means to be saved, and James says there's got to be works there or else you're not saved, then, oh my goodness, you spend your whole life thinking, I hope I'm doing enough good things. Am I doing the right kind of good things? Because I want to make sure that the works are proving my faith is legit. And that becomes a very fearful way to live. When we understand, though, that salvation that Jesus is talking about and promising us is about a life that is full and complete and whole, a life that is marked by the pursuit of the wisdom of God. And this is something talked about in the Hebrew Bible, and it's characterized by that word shalom, which means so much more than merely peace, but it speaks to a good welfare and well-being and that wholeness and completeness. When we understand that salvation is living a whole and complete and full life, well, then that changes the terms of this discussion. So now Ephesians is saying that our entry into that wholeness and fullness of life is indeed a gift of God. It's something that God has brought about for us, that that capacity is there, that we can enter that full and whole life. And James is saying that the evidence that one is living into that full and whole life is that you are not living as an individual, caring only for yourself, but also considering others. Coming right back to that whole thing that Jesus said about loving God and loving our neighbors. And one could say that we show our love for God by loving our neighbors. That's how we show that faith is there. You love your neighbors, that's how you demonstrate you love God. With that definition now, we can see that there really isn't much contradiction. On top of that, when this debate comes up, people forget that there's a verse 10 in Ephesians 2. Ephesians 2, 8, 9, and 10 says this: "It is by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not of yourselves, it's a gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast. For we are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God prepared in advance for us to do." So even Paul is putting works and faith together anyway. So the two of them are together in Ephesians, and the two of them are clearly together in James. So why did we get the idea that there was ever one versus the other in the first place? You got to read the whole thing, right? But now there's one other thing to consider. When we think about the word faith, what do we mean? We often think of faith as being mental assent, saying, this is what I believe. These are the things that I would declare to be true and that I'm convinced of. Okay, but let me just point out the obvious. These are two different words, right? Belief and faith. And sometimes we say that words are synonymous, but they are different words. Faith is not merely belief. Belief is part of faith, but it is not all that faith is. Faith is the trust that we put in something or someone. Faith is what it is that we are counting on for our lives. Faith is the basket into which we put all of our eggs. And that's so much more than just belief. And so when we think of faith in that term then, we realize that it is more than just reciting the creed or signing off on a statement of faith that other churches often have. It's something deeper and something greater. And here's the interesting thing. James takes this hypothetical situation where someone in this discussion says, oh, well, you have faith and I have works. And what that's basically setting up is that, you know, someone might say, you know, there's different ways of living out the Christian life and all of that. And so, you know, someone might be a faith person. Like they say, I believe this and I believe with all my heart and I can articulate all the beliefs and I can tell you. Whereas someone else in living out their faith might be, you know what, I don't know about all the belief thing. I just go ahead and do good things for people, right? Isn't that the same thing? Well, James says, no, actually. Show me your faith without works. And I will show you through my works what my faith is. By what I do, you will know where my faith is. So that's interesting. He's saying that my actions, my work being done, reveals my faith. So he did another scenario. He said, imagine there's someone out there who doesn't have any clothes and they don't have any food. What good is it to say to them, hey, you know, God bless you, keep warm, keep well fed. The blessing of God be upon you, you know? And he says, what good is that, right? The guy still doesn't have any clothes. The guy's still starving. It doesn't make any sense just to, you know, bless him in the name of God. No, you got to do something about it. So let's say someone comes across a person here in Calgary, doesn't have a coat, it's 40 below, and that person decides, I'm going to do something about it, goes and buys the guy a nice winter jacket, brings it to him, gives it to him, and says, there you go, now you can stay warm, and here's a few bucks to buy some food or something, right? If someone witnessed that, James says that that would show something about that person's faith. Well, what would it show? It would show that they're convinced that helping others is important. It would show that they recognize that they're not to live all by themselves. It would show that they recognize the importance of not only helping somebody else, but seeing somebody else as a full human being who ought to be treated similarly and that kind of thing. In short, it would show that this is a person who understands that you're supposed to love your neighbor as yourself. And didn't Jesus say something about that? Yeah, I think he did. What that action would not show about that person's faith is whether or not they believe that Jesus was really born of a virgin. It would not show whether that person believed that God is Trinity. It would not show whether a person believed that Jesus was really God. But obviously, James isn't too concerned about that. Now, I'm not saying that what you believe is not important. I'm not saying that theology and doctrine are not important. But let's understand that James is taking as an assumption that whatever the theology is about God that the people he's writing to have, what he's wanting to emphasize is that to follow in the way of Jesus is to do the kinds of things that Jesus would do. Just declaring you believe something about God isn't good enough. In chapter 2, verse 19, he says, you believe in one God? Great. The demons believe that too. And it doesn't do anything for them. In fact, they shudder. So just belief alone, ascribing to a set of beliefs is not sufficient. James is trying to make that clear. And this is not something he's just pulling out of a hat somewhere. If we think back to our gospel, what is it that we read this morning that we heard? Jesus is about halfway through his ministry, and he's talking to his apostles, and he says to them, guys, I just want to find out from you, what are people saying about me? Who do they say that I am? And so they say, well, some of them think that you're John the Baptist, come back from the dead somehow, and others think that you're Elijah, because, of course, we know that Elijah went into heaven on chariots of fire and never died, so maybe Elijah's back, and others think that maybe you're just one of the prophets in general. And then Jesus says, okay, that's great. What about you? Who do you say that I am? Let me reword it. Who do you believe that I am? And Peter steps forward, speaking for them all, and says, you're the Messiah. You're the Christ. So there's their belief. But then, in the same passage, Jesus gathers his apostles and a bunch of other people and says, if any of you want to be my followers, you must deny yourselves, take up your cross daily, and follow me. He didn't say, you got the answer right. Yes, you're right. I'm the Messiah. Good for you. Done. You're covered. He says to his apostles who made that declaration, and to everybody else, being one of my followers means acting on the reality that I'm there. So, of course, back then, the disciples and the apostles could literally follow Jesus around. They left their livelihoods to follow him. James and John left their dad sitting in a fishing boat while they went off to follow Jesus, right? You know, it was pretty easy to follow Jesus in that context because you just literally follow him. But the majority of Christians on the planet have not ever had Jesus walking around to literally follow. So how do you follow Jesus? Well, you walk in his way. And that's actually what the early Christians called themselves. They called themselves the way or the followers of the way. Jesus said, I am the way, right? They're followers of Jesus. There's something to be done. The word Christian doesn't show up until later. And even then, that was told by their opponents who were making fun of them. Oh, look at those Christ people over there, right? So followers of the way is how Christians define themselves from the beginning. Well, again, what way is that? It's the way that Jesus demonstrated, loving God and loving neighbor. showing our love for God by loving our neighbor in the first place, being ones who would act for the benefit of others, just like Jesus did. So when James says, a faith without works, a faith that simply says, I believe, but doesn't do anything, can that faith make you completely whole? No, it can't. Mental assent, just saying I believe something, is not the road to wholeness and completeness, because our wholeness and completeness depends on our participation with others, our participation in the creation that God has made, our participation as one who is not an island, but part and parcel with everyone and everything else. That is what Jesus is calling us to. That is what Jesus is inviting us to. And that is what James is wanting to ensure that his congregation, and by extension, that we continue to embrace. The story is told of an Amish man who was asked a question. The Amish are part of the Mennonite expression of the Christian faith. And similar to Hutterites, they tend to have a very simple approach to life, basically an agricultural society, not a whole lot of technology, no computers and cell phones and stuff, a lot of horses and things like that. Anyway, you usually see them, the guys are wearing these beards with no mustache and stuff. Anyway, the point is, this Amish man was asked, are you a Christian? His answer, you'll have to ask my neighbor. Isn't that the perfect answer for exactly what James is talking about? Let's keep these things in mind as we move forward in pursuing that wholeness and fullness of life that Jesus invites us to embrace. Amen.